There are many ways people listen to Vision, including in cars through the Vision app.
The Vision app is compatible with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, so if you have mobile coverage, you can stream any of Vision's live radio channels in crystal clear quality and enjoy a growing range of on-demand podcasts all on the go. There are other ways to connect your phone to your vehicle's speakers too. You can see detailed instructions when you Google ways to listen to Vision.
However and wherever you listen to Vision, you can be sure that the announcers, programs and music will help you look to God daily. Life, culture and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
Neil Johnson with you. It is the Friday edition of 2020 and an inspiring story today of a life filled with practical faith and determination that takes an Aussie kid raised on an outback sheep station to a high-flying world mixing with the rich and the famous. It's a story about character forged in the bush as preparation for conquering the business world. It's the story of an outback kid raised on a family property called Jumble Plains in western New South Wales. That's just west of Dubbo. To a business high flyer crossing the Atlantic on the Concorde as casually as most people catch a bus. It's the boy from the bush whose achievements include redeveloping the Rocks area on Sydney's foreshore. He led the biggest property development company in Sydney. He's led the company that developed a city in Egypt for 45,000 people and was eventually appointed president of what became the world's largest gold company, Barrick Gold. There's a roller coaster ride in there, in times of plenty and challenging times of despair. But it's not all about business. Tony McClellan has also made an enormous contribution to the Christian foundations of modern Australia. For nearly 10 years, he was the chairman of the Australian Christian Lobby, honoured on his retirement with the title Chairman Emeritus. Tony McClellan has just released his story in a book called A Glorious Ride, From Jumble Plains to Eternity, written with political and cultural commentator Nick Cater, and a foreword by former Prime Minister John Howard. It's our absolute privilege to share some insights from Tony's life today. A special welcome along to 2020 to you, Tony McClellan.
Well, Neil, thank you very much. You've honoured me greatly. Thank you.
Tony, the very first words in the opening chapter, you say, the first secret to success in life is to choose your ancestors well. Well, we don't always get to choose our family, but you might like to take us back to your family environment in those early days.
Well, thank you, Neil. Thank you. I had the very good fortune to be the grandson of a very successful Scottish migrant. Actually, he was born in Australia, but his dad came out from Scotland, and it was he who selected the Jumble Plains property and developed it and became extremely well known in the district. And my dad came along as one of six kids in the family, and he took over the property. But my dad was an alcoholic, and was a struggle for him to achieve what his father had achieved. And eventually, at age 44, in fact, on his 44th birthday, he died in a lonely hospital bed in Tullamore Hospital.
And those beginnings, as you say, you can trace your ancestry, a wonderful, solid and inspirational grandfather, and your own father, who no doubt you loved, but there were some weaknesses there. At the end of your first chapter, I started with those first words, at the end of your first chapter, and reflecting on your life at Jumble Plains and all sorts of things, scraping the maggots off the sheep, mending fences and killing rabbits, you use the words, the doggedness and staying power I learned on the land are the universal keys to success in life. those hardships of being raised on a sheep station and the challenges and the good things about family, these things shape us, don't they?
They sure do. They sure do. And when you live in the bush and raised in the bush, it's all sort of natural. It's part of life. And it doesn't really occur to you what you're doing. But it's so different. If you've got a fence down, you can't say, well, I'll come back on Tuesday and do that. You have to do it now. If the windmill breaks down, well, you have to climb it yourself and fix it. There's just no time for mucking around. You have to roll up your sleeves and get stuck into it. And I think the age of 16, when my dad died, when I took over running the property, it really impacted me, the responsibility to get things done.
Responsibility and work ethic. In fact, that carried on right into your career as you got a start, and working 60 hours a week, 6 days a week, a big factor in success?
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it was. And I still work long hours now. But on the land, you don't sort of clock on and clock off. You just do what you have to do that day. And whatever day of the week it is, you just roll up your sleeves and do it. And I think that's a big advantage to me. And when we moved, my wife and I moved to Sydney so I could study, that sort of culture and belief was such an important factor in my doing well at my studies. So I think I just decided to get stuck into it and work really hard and with a lot of determination and commitment, not particularly about my intellect, it's about my work ethic, I think.
Work ethic important, and you applied that into your study. You were studying property valuation and becoming involved in property development, and that led to a couple of big opportunities there where you began to move into some really significant ways that you were participating, even in the development of what we know as modern Sydney.
Well, I've had the great pleasure and honour of working on some major projects, helping to plan them, put them together, do the feasibility studies, and both in Sydney and Melbourne and also in Adelaide. And that led to my being asked by the New South Wales government to give them advice on the redevelopment of the Sydney Rocks area, which I worked on for over a year. And it was a lot of intense work, but a great pleasure. And that in turn led to my being invited to visit Egypt and look at this new project. It was in the planning stage, meet the Egyptian officials. And when I came back, the chairman of the company said, thank you very much for your comments. They're very helpful. Now I'd like you to go and run it, which was such a shock to me. But he was very persuasive and became a real mentor of mine, and I obviously talked to my wife about it, and we decided to learn back up and take the three kids and move to Egypt, and that's what we did.
You moved to Egypt. You even learnt Arabic so you could communicate in the business community,
right.
And you found yourself then mixing in circles with the president of Egypt. And while everything went smoothly in those early planning stages, not everything went smoothly for you as things began to get to a point where real progress would be made.
That's right. That's right. And it was it was an honour and a joy. I met some very famous people, not only the president, but his ministers, and of course the major investors in the company, mainly from Saudi Arabia, but also from the Gulf. And so being able to speak Arabic was a huge plus in dealing with those. Even though I wasn't polished and perfectly fluent, I could understand most things, and they could, I think, really appreciate the fact that I'd made an effort and made the whole sort of atmosphere much more productive. And in due course, when the project is starting to really take shape. President Sadat's opposition, he allowed opposition for the first time, political opposition. They started to mount a campaign to bring the project to an end because they felt that this was really Egypt. Although Egypt owned 40% of the project and would own 100% after 99 years, they didn't like that particularly and mounted a campaign. And eventually President Sadat, and might have been a fantastic promoter and supporter of the project, decided one day to cancel it. So that was a huge, it wasn't a shock in a way, but it was, it came out of the blue. And so that we have 1,000 people working on the project there. So it had to be demobilized and then went through a whole lot of legal steps. And eventually we launched into a claim against the government of Egypt for the cancellation of the project under the contract we had. They weren't able to do that. And that claim lasted then for 13 3/4 years, went on and on and on. And it was only, I think, probably the country upbringing that gave me the determination and the resolution to keep fighting. And eventually, I'm jumping ahead of myself here, eventually the Egyptian government's attorney came to our house. We were then living in Atlanta, Georgia, USA, came to our house, had lunch, went downstairs to my office and made the offer, which we accepted. I brought that to an end after 13 3/4 years, millions and millions of dollars in legal fees and huge amount of anguish and effort to get there.
One of those parallel things that happen when you are in the business world, sometimes fighting a corporate court battle while you're pursuing other dimensions of your own career. But it's not all about business in your book too, and I might say congratulations, because this year you marked 60 years of marriage to your wife, Ray, and it's all a part of what you might appreciate in the title of your book, A Glorious Ride. I wonder whether you can take us back to those early days. You're courting Ray, and you're not bad at cracking the head off a black snake. Let's just change a bit of direction here, because this was one of your early dates.
What a story. I did that without really thinking about it, wanting to show off, no doubt, to this beautiful school teacher, probably 19 years old. And I had dance orchestras in the bush, and I was off to an engagement, picked her up to take her with me, and running along the long dusty road and the big black snake crossing, and said, "Have you ever seen how you crack the head off a snake?" And we braked and broke the back of the snake, and I jumped out of the car and went to pick it up. And it ran up and struck at me. Unfortunately, I was able to leap back out of its reach. But I did kill it. And then I said, "Now let me show you what I do." And I picked the snake up by its tail and cracked it, and its head flew off into the bush somewhere. And we got back into the ute to carry on to the dance. And there on the dashboard was the forked tongue of the snake. It had come out of its head somehow and come in through the open window and stuck on the dashboard. And here's this poor 19-year-old girl from the city was appalled to see a forked tongue on the dashboard. So that maybe locked in our relationship. But it's the most glorious thing. I could never, ever imagine anything more important than that wonderful, wonderful woman of mine.
Visions 2020 with Neil Johnson. A biblical perspective on life, culture, and current events.
Wonderful to have you with us. And our special guest this hour is Tony McLellan, just released his story in a book called A Glorious Ride from Jumbled Plains to Eternity. Tony, if we pick up your story, you were having that, as we described, the parallel corporate court battles over the city that you were building in Egypt. But you were offered a wonderful opportunity to become president of what would become the biggest gold company in the world. Tell us about your connection to Barrick Gold.
Well, thank you, Neil. The chairman of the company responsible for the city in Egypt was a fellow called Peter Munk, who's a Hungarian Jewish man who'd migrated to Canada and was an outstanding person who I really admired, and I'm sure he did me. He asked me, after the nationalisation, we moved to London, and I was working with him in the office in London, and he asked me if I'd be prepared to go to Toronto and build a new office for he and his colleagues. And I agreed to do that. We went and got the office up and running, and he moved across. Not so long after, a few months after, he called me one day, said, "Tony, are you free?" And I said, "Oh, in 5 minutes, I'll finish what I'm doing and I'll come and meet you." And I went up to, he arranged to meet in the hotel almost next door, walked in the room, and he was there with his partner. And he said, we've decided to sell our hotel chain. They owned 69 hotels and resorts, principally in the Pacific. I said, "Boy, congratulations." And he said, "Yes, and we want to start a resources company in gold and oil and gas. And we want you to be president." And I said, "Peter, why would you ask me? I'm a property guy. I don't do anything about gold or mining or oil and gas." And he said, "No, you are a goer. You get things done. You roll up your sleeves and make things happen. And you're trustworthy, and David and I respect you, and we'd like you to do it." I was so flattered and so taken back, and I went home, talked to Ray, and Ray pretty wisely said, "Well, if you say no, that might be the end of your career." But anyway, I said yes, and we did roll up our sleeves and get stuck at it, and we founded this company, and I was president of it, and we got it going, and then got more diverted into the gold side of into the oil and gas side of the business, and that led to our moving from Toronto to, first of all, Tulsa, Oklahoma, where we'd bought an oil and gas company, and then on to Houston, where we had another oil and gas company, and built those up, I'm just very, very grateful for the support and encouragement that Peter gave me over many, many years.
When your background is in real estate and property development, and all of a sudden you're made a different offer, the qualities of the character of your life are recognised by people who headhunt you or cherry-pick you for these sorts of positions. And so you didn't just land into a new office. You went and did a crash course in geology so you could understand gold and oil and gas. So the adaptability there, is this something that comes back to some of those character traits forged at the sheep station too?
Oh, I suppose they do. I have always been intellectually inquisitive, and I suppose that's one of the reasons why I did well in my studies. And I was told I had the highest grades since 1929, so that was pretty flattering, and won all the prizes and so on. And that's because I worked hard, and because I wanted to find the real answers. And then I lectured in the areas for a number of years, examination and so on. And I suppose when I had a new challenge like that, I wanted to at least understand what the terms were. When you meet people in the industry, they use a whole lot of terms that you only occasionally stumble across. And I wanted to get a bit of an understanding, so I got stuck into that, and that was very helpful. And I must tell you that Peter Monk, the chairman, is extremely intelligent. He's now passed, extremely intelligent, and was very, very good to work with. And as I say in my book, one of the outstanding things about him is that he's never too proud to take advice. And so he would ask me to have a cup of tea with him, and so I've just come up with this idea to do this, and I'd say, what about we do it that way? Oh, Tony, that's a much better idea. Instantly changes his mind if he thought it was a better idea. It's so attractive in top-level business. Often you find people who think they know it all and they're not willing to listen or debate or discuss, and Peter was completely the opposite, and it was a real joy to work with.
You say in your book, in working with Peter Monk and into a very big and exciting resources company, gold, oil and gas, interestingly, yes, you were well paid in the position. But he had a very particular way that he was really, in some sense, I think you describe, bringing out the best in you, when he suggested that when you travel, and you were doing a lot of traveling, I mentioned in the early introduction, on the Concorde aircraft, as casually as most people catch a bus, but he said to you, why don't you take Ray, your wife, with you on your travels? And that was an expensive exercise to go on the Concorde first class, but it was something that you hold very dear, that in the sense of your boss saying you can travel with your wife, you took that and to heart and were very inspired by that.
I was, Neil. It was an absolute joy. At one stage, it was the period when we're getting Barrick off the ground, I spent 35% of my nights in a foreign country and leave Toronto, go to Europe every few weeks and all over the world. And Peter picked this up and said, oh, it's not fair to Ray. Why don't you take Ray with you and we'll pay? And so I'd say to Ray, well, I'm going to Paris next Thursday. Would you like to come? Well, I'd love to come. So off we'd go to Paris, and it was so good because she did the laundry lists and organise the receptions. At the end of the day, I'm out there raising money for the new company, and she was an enormous help. And then I'd say to her, well, I'm going to Ankara in 2 weeks. Do you want to come? Well, I was in Ankara last week. Oh, why would I want to go back to Ankara? You know, after a while, have you been to the places once? You're not so keen to go a second time a few weeks later. And so the extent of the cost of it wasn't through the roof. And I made, in fact, a very crude estimate and came to the conclusion that we'd spent about $50,000 on airfares for Ray, her accommodation. Of course, it's just included my accommodation and so on. And I thought to myself, wow, it's given me so much delight and pleasure and honour. For $50,000, if Peter had said, Tony, I'll give you a bonus of $50,000 on my salary in those days, would have, it was a bit paltry, and I'd have had to pay tax on it. With her included, it was tax-free. It was created so much joy in my heart, and Ray's too. A very, very smart move. And I've never found anybody before or since who'd done a similar thing.
Treating our staff well is a key, no doubt, to bringing out the best in loyalty.
Yes, I suppose that's right. That's right. And in the book, I quote two or three letters that exchanges of correspondence I've had with Peter, which just shows the enormous mutual respect. It's just fantastic. And
Traveling on the Concorde all over the world. You were mixing with all sorts of famous people. You tell the story of your encounters with Paul and Linda McCartney and with the actor Christopher Reeve, who played Superman. And you've got your reflections on them. We won't go into those details about those encounters. Listeners mightn't need to get the book to get those. But I want to take you to age 47. You describe it as a midlife crisis and a significant year for you, and you began to pay attention to your spiritual life. What was happening there?
Well, thank you. For some strange reason, we'd sporadically gone to church. You know, we might have been in New York on a Sunday. Would you like to go to church? Oh, yeah, that's not a bad idea. But we weren't regular churchgoers by any means. And I met Michael Youssef in Atlanta, introduced by a fellow who was intrigued by my connection with Egypt and introduced me over lunch. Michael said, I've just started a new church and I'd love you to come along. And after pestering us a bit, we went along on Christmas Eve with our kids, our three and three friends from college, and we filled up a whole pew and absolutely loved the service. And Michael did what, as Michael, as all good pastors should, came and visited us a week after we'd been there to sort of find out more about us and sort of welcome us to the church. In the meantime, Ray and I had had a terrible argument. And Ray said, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. I'm going to go back to Australia. And I said, oh, that's fine. I've just heard that so many times. And I went off to a tennis ranch to play tennis for a couple of days. And I came back and Ray had gone. And I couldn't believe that she had the courage to do it. And Michael came just after I got back and said, where's Ray? And I said, she's gone back to Australia. We have this awful row. I was absolutely broken, in tears. And he said, you need Jesus. And I said, no, I need help. I didn't know who Jesus was. And anyway, he sat down with me. We prayed. I sought forgiveness and wept extensively. And my life changed.
With Dr. Michael Youssef, he led you in some ways here that gave you new perspective on your life, that your life doesn't revolve around you. You were not the center of the universe. I wonder if you can reflect on how things were changing with your encounter with Jesus Christ.
Well, it's absolutely amazing. And of course, not having been steeped in a Christian background, I didn't really understand it, and I'm not sure how it all emerged. But Michael is very smart with business people in particular, and he knows how to encourage them. One of the things he did, which I thought was crazy at the time, but he asked me, I was saved in January, and he asked me in February if I'd lead a Bible study group. And I said, Michael, I don't know anything about the Bible. Well, and he said, no, you're a leader. You'll be good at it. So I started in May and with a group at home and got to enjoy it and like it, and I got encouraged. I ended up leading five Bible studies a week, typically early in the morning, but I was doing one at the church and one at home and so on. And what happened is that I learned something about the Bible because I was so intent on not making a fool of myself when I was reading the studies. I did so much work and make so many notes that I, in fact, taught myself the Bible in the process. Tony, a very smart move of Michael's.
These were hard times for you as well, those Christian early Christian years.
They
because
were.
Under Michael Youssef, you reflect on your involvement in church and Christian ministry at the time. You were developing a software company called clickchoice.com, and you almost lost it all. Take us into some of this hardship.
We did, in fact, lose it all. I had some plans to raise capital, and was unsuccessful. Couldn't raise the amounts that we needed, and poured more and more of our savings in there, and got to a point where we sold our two cars to generate some cash, and we got further and further behind, and blow me down if we didn't have our house foreclosed on. We lost our house, so we had no house, a little tiny little bit of furniture left, no cars, and we were broke. We were wondering how we'd be able to feed ourselves. We had amazing support from people, just unexpectedly. We came home from church one Sunday, and there's a $100 note pinned to the door, and it just said, "We love you." No idea from where it came. One time I was invited to breakfast by a comfortable professional man who said, "Come to my car afterwards, come to the trunk of the car," as they say in America. And he pulled out a checkbook and gave me $5,000. And he said, there's only one condition. I want you, when you are able, to pass that on to someone else, which we later did. We did pass it on to somebody else. And I said, there were two conditions. One is you pass it on to someone else, and the second condition is you ring Joe Spence and thank him, because he was the source of it. And of course, Joe was absolutely tickled that A, I was free, and B, that the money was being circulated again. Fantastic idea. So we struggled for a while, quite a while, and eventually met a fellow from the Netherlands, very famous software man, and he came to visit us, was really taken with what we're doing, and the following morning said to me over breakfast, "Would 10 million do?" I said, "Yes!" And he invested 10 million and another 15 million, and we built it up to 50 people and took it public. So it was an incredible a recovery from a very sad situation.
Tony, at risk of losing some momentum here, let's pause a moment, because undoubtedly there are listeners tuned in to us today. We're talking to people, and in New South Wales and Victoria, where in particular there's some real hardship going on. Some people lost their jobs, feeling as though all hope has dried up. I wonder whether you've got a thought or two here. Having heard that a high flyer can come close to losing it all, and your sustaining faith in God, I wonder if you've got a word of wisdom for people who might be going through something beyond difficult right now.
Well, thank you. One of the things we learned was that in those days, Ray and I used to kneel beside the bed to pray every evening. And now we're in our 80s. We're not capable of kneeling by the bed, but we'd never miss our evening prayers. But we found ourselves just unable to concentrate to pray, because we were so jagged by the financial predicament. And we learned to concentrate on giving thanks for what we had. And that was, in fact, given, that idea was given to us by one of Michael Youssef's assistants, who has said, concentrate on giving thanks for what you do have, and let the other things flow. And that was a huge, huge thing. And also, in parallel, we were supporters of a ministry called Walk Through the Bible. And I was on the President's Council, and we went to a retreat one weekend. And the retreat involved several lectures, talks on John 15, the vine, how God prunes you to make you bear more fruit. So if you remain in Christ and are faithful to Him, He will. You can be sure He'll come along and clip you to help you become more productive. And you know, when it's happening, when you're broke, when it's happening, you wonder what the heck I've done wrong. Why am I being punished like this? And don't realize that He's setting you up for something else. And we made a huge effort to confess all known and unknown sins so that we could benefit from that and blow me down if He didn't just bring us. Well, He brought us this investor and just changed our life. And we came back to Australia just completely different people after almost 30 years abroad, and huge believers in how God honors the faithfulness to Him.
The encouragement is God can change the trajectory at any moment, and to keep incredible. That thankful heart and expect with hope that God is going to intervene in your circumstances. Age 47, a midlife crisis, an encounter with Jesus, and your life was on a different direction from this time forward. You met the founder of the organization Half Time, Bob Buford, of course, Half Time is all about what you're going to do with the second half of your life to make it count for the things
exactly
of God.
Right.
And you've now begun to you began to invest yourself in the projects that were about kingdom orientation. Take us into some of those.
Well, when we were still in Atlanta, I founded a ministry to protect people, families from pornography, and raised a lot of money, about $1 million to get that underway in Atlanta, involved all the major churches in Atlanta, and then joined the board of the sort of a floating company in that area, founded another organization called We Care America, and worked with President Bush, who had decided that the best way to get social work done was for the federal government to invest in it through religious organizations. And we were responsible for bringing the religious organizations to the government. And that was a great honor and a great piece of work. And then I joined the board of Opportunity International, came back to Australia, continued with that appointment. Before long, I was asked if I'd become chairman of Habitat for Humanity. We were close to in Atlanta because that was the headquarters of this fantastic organization, builds houses for the working poor. And when I joined them here in Australia, we were doing about 3 houses a year. When I left, we were doing about 1,000. And we had the great joy, unbelievable joy, of helping out following the tsunami in Indonesia, particularly Aceh. And collectively, Habitat built about 25,000 houses to replace those that were washed away. And that was a huge, huge challenge and a great joy and much delight in that. And whilst that was going on, I was approached by Jim Wallace to join the Australian Christian Lobby.
Let's talk about those years, because this was a very important element of your life, 10 years as chairman of the Australian Christian Lobby, and these were early years. What was going on in those early years?
Well, the interesting thing, when I joined up, we had about 3,500 members or supporters, and we've got 220,000 now. It's grown enormously, and I don't mean that that's the result of my work, but, you know, obviously it was part of the effort to expand, and just had an unbelievable pleasure. And Jim was managing director at the time, and he retired. Lyle Shelton became managing director, and I fell in love with Lyle, who I respect enormously, and I keep in touch with him probably once a week, try to help when I can. And then, of course, when Lyle retired, we appointed Martin Isles. It was just a sensation, and the organization's gone from strength to strength. It's been an absolute joy to be associated with, and it's sort of its success, its expansion, its impact has affected in so many aspects of my life. But, you know, I feel I'm getting some of the credit put on me, which is not correct, but I've really, really enjoyed that time, as I did with the other organizations, Habitat and Opportunity, just one thing after another. They've been, all have been sort of training, and of course I was chairman of many public companies when I came back, because I'd been president of the Barrack. People asked me to join a number of publicly listed companies in the mining sector, which I did, and I was chairman of three companies at the same time, and that taught me a lot about governance and policy development and so on, which was probably helpful to Habitat and Opportunity. Well, of them all.
Tony, let's stay with the Australian Christian Lobby for a moment, because one of the early aims of the Australian Christian Lobby was to secure a place for Christianity in the public square. I wonder if you've got any reflection on how things have changed since you took on the role as chairman, and of course you're retired from that now, an emeritus chairmanship role now. But what are your thoughts about Christianity in the public square here in Australia today?
Well, I think it's fair to say, Neil, that there's an increasing number of people who don't like the influence of Christianity in the public square, and are lashing out, and it's very difficult to maintain your faith, maintain your course in the face of all this. Every day we learn new things, new legislation coming through. We're just constantly fighting. It's getting worse and worse and tougher. We're about Queensland, where you are, just had your terrible legislation on giving doctors the right to go and kill their patients. And we've had it introduced here in Sydney. And we're about to mount another fight here in New South Wales. And unfortunately, most people now are just tired of it and say, oh, let's just let it happen, without thinking about the principles. It's sick-making. There's just an increasing amount of work to do.
There's a necessity for having Christianity front and centre in the public square. Tony, we're running short of time. You finish your book with a chapter on advice to the younger me. What was your reflection? What would you have done differently? What would you have said to a young Tony McLellan?
There's a, as you say, there's a chapter there, but I'm very, I think, done wryly, but I really wanted to say to the young Tony, if he were at 16, 15, taking over from his dad, what I'd like to have known then, and share with this metaphorical young Tony my advice to him. And I've said a whole lot of things, including, you know, getting getting your priorities right. Do what it takes. Focus on one thing. It's so easy to get waylaid and diverted. Examine your life. I remember saying that it's we have to keep thinking about what the things we're doing. How is this making the world a better place? Encourage people, getting your priorities right, and so on. And in the final thing, I talk about grace. And I tell the story of the Habsburgs and the burial of the final leader, and how he is finally they introduce him in a humble way. We bear the body of Franz Joseph, our brother, a sinner like us all. And I end up by saying that the doors swung open and the body was allowed into the family crypt, and neither wealth nor fame can open the ways of salvation, which is only available through God's grace, given to those who will humbly acknowledge their need. And that, young Tony, is the most important advice I can give you. And may God bless you as you earnestly seek His face.
Important to reflect on.
At the end of my, later in my time, wanting to make the point that to young people, I hope, that they'll think about this now, not at age 47.
Well, your business career and your humanitarian work, your work with the Australian Christian Lobby, all of these wonderful dimensions. We haven't even had time to get onto another project, the Chrysos Corporation, a partnership with the CSIRO. Yes. That's given you all sorts of freedoms in your older years, working with delivering faster and safer and accurate ways to analyze gold, things that many of us might not even think about. But I'll have to leave listeners to read that part of your story in your book. One last dimension. These days, you're battling some health issues. You mentioned polymyalgia rheumatica. How are you and Ray going health-wise in your older years?
Well, it's very nice of you to ask. I believe the polymyalgia rheumatica is under control and taking steroids, and they have removed all the pain. And I'm weaning off them gradually, and I believe we'll be off them totally in another few months. So I'm totally relaxed about that. Ray has had two heart attacks. She goes back every 6 months and has another heart test come through with flying colors. So thanks God, we are both well. And but, you know, we're getting on in years. Can't do the things we used to do. But we're enjoying our retirement very well, and this blessing of this incredible investment in Corporation is just absolutely extraordinary. And God knew that if He blessed it, that we'd give the money away. And so he said, I can rely on the McClellans. I know what they're going to do. I'll bless them.
Well, the boy from the bush, growing up on a sheep station, Jumble Plains, Tony McClellan, a special honour to you. What a wonderful story it is. And your dimensions of working with Australian Christian Lobby and those humanitarian organisations, just wonderful. I want to point listeners, this is the sort of book that you will enjoy. You need this one on your bookshelf, and no doubt it'll be one you'll come back to time and again for inspiration. Tony McClellan has just released his story. The book is called A Glorious Ride from Jumble Plains to Eternity. I mentioned earlier it's written with political and cultural commentator Nick Cater, and there's a foreword by the former Prime Minister John Howard. there is a way you can get a hold of it. Simply Google A Glorious Ride from Jumble Planes to Eternity. It'll be available from all online booksellers. And there is some websites around all sorts of dimensions of Tony's involvement. There is one called the McClellanFoundation.org. Is that one that people can connect with you in some ways with, Tony?
Well, that won't give any particular information about us, but I'm always available. I have a web address, tony@McClellanFoundation.org. People can contact me there at any time. And always like to meet new people, I can tell you that.
All right. And an invitation there for listeners, tony@McClellanFoundation.org. The book is A Glorious Ride from Jumble Planes to Eternity. Tony McClellan, thanks so much for taking some time to share your thoughts and your heart with listeners today on 2020.
Neil, you're wonderful. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for taking time to listen to this audio on demand from Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, go to vision.org.au.